I want to begin just by mentioning Psalm 145, the verse 4. We have a lot of ground to cover, so I'm not going to spend much time on this, but Psalm 145, verse 4 says, "One generation shall praise thy works to another and shall declare thy mighty acts," which is exactly what we're doing here as we look into the life and the times and the ministry of Samuel Kirkland, missionary to the Oneida Indians. Now, last Lord's Day afternoon, I shared much background information relevant to the subject of this presentation concerning Samuel Kirkland, missionary to the Oneida Indians. Samuel Kirkland was born at Norwich, Connecticut, on the 1st of December, 1741. He was the 10th child and 5th son of a family of 12 children. His father was a congregational minister, the Reverend Daniel Kirkland. His mother's name was Hannah. Her maiden name was Hannah Perkins. Daniel and Hannah were of Scottish birth and had immigrated to America. Now, there's almost no information available on Samuel Kirkland's childhood. We know that in October of 1760, he entered Dr. Eliezer Wheelock's school, Moore's Charity School, and joined the many Indian youth that were studying there already. The year after Kirkland entered this school, a Mohawk Indian boy whose English name was Joseph Brant became his schoolmate. I spoke of Brant last week. It said, and I'm not positive on this, but it said that Samuel was the first white charity student to enter Wheelock School at Lebanon, Connecticut. Now, I spoke, of course, last message much on Dr. Wheelock and his school. The record is that Samuel Kirkland, while there, was very highly esteemed and loved by his fellow students, which of course, were Indian youth. From Wheelock School, Samuel entered Princeton College. And by the way, there were a number of Indian students there who attended Princeton at the same time he did, which would probably be a surprise to those rewriters of history who claim the whole body of white men in this nation viewed the red man as being no more than sort of a subhuman, incapable of being improved either intellectually, morally, or spiritually. Samuel Kirkland apparently never finished his studies at Princeton. To some degree, it might have been because of his poverty, but certainly in large degree, it was because he was so eager to take the gospel to the Indians, he just couldn't wait any longer. Apparently, Kirkland's zeal was stirred up to carry the gospel to the Indians of the Iroquois Confederation by a Christian brother who had been the chaplain of a regiment of colonial troops during the French and Indian War, and he had passed through the country of the Iroquois. Now, last week I spoke of that powerful six-nation Iroquois confederacy, which included the Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, Seneca, and Tuscarora nations. These Iroquois were known for their fighting ability, but also their eloquence. The former chaplain aptly described the Iroquois to the young Kirkland as warlike, and spoke in stirring terms of what a wonderful, glorious thing it would be if those Indians had the gospel preached to them and the scriptures taught to them. Now, I might mention here in passing that some also called the Iroquois Mingos. Now, of the Six Nation Confederacy, the Seneca were at that time the most numerous, powerful, and according to era sources, quote, in the most savage state. It's to the Senecas, then, that Samuel Kirkland first decided to go. At the time he began his ministry, there had been only several short-term efforts at gospel ministry to the Mohawks and to the Oneidas, and there had been no attempts to other tribes. Now, the Algonquian-speaking tribes of New England, as we've talked about before, and the Delaware Indians of New Jersey had been evangelized, in some cases, quite thoroughly. But it wasn't so with the Iroquois tribes. Now, Samuel Kirkland then resolved to set about proclaiming to the wild men of that region the glorious hope and promises of the gospel, as he put it. Like John Eliot, the apostle to the Indians in the century previous, Samuel Kirkland was a bold man. He was sacrificial. He was persevering. He was courageous. He was constitutionally strong, and he had a heart devoted to the cause of Christ and the saving of souls, especially Indian souls. Both also had a great desire to see the Indians educated and to see them adopt a civilized, happy, fruitful way of life. So Kirkland decided to take the gospel to the Seneca Indians as already mentioned, the largest tribe, perhaps the most savage, and also as yet unexposed to gospel preaching. So this was a very hazardous undertaking, including because the Seneca had already sent word that they did not want any Protestant missionaries among them. It was at the age of 23 on November 20th, 1764, that Samuel Kirkland set out for the land of the Senecas. At the same time, Joseph Woolley, a Delaware Indian, also educated at Wheelock School at Lebanon, set out to reside among the Mohawks as a schoolteacher. This was a fine young man who had a short ministry life since he died young. So Samuel Kirkland went out with Woolley first to the chief village of the Mohawks and helped to settle him there. One of the Mohawks, a truly Christian Indian among a sea of heathens, an exhorter named Good Peter, warned Kirkland that the Seneca were not yet ready to peacefully receive a missionary. Now this Good Peter lived a long, noble Christian life and played a very important part in many important events connected to gospel work among the Indians. But Samuel Kirkland was resolved to go to the Seneca, come what may, life or death, and he set off, in fact, through very severe weather and much snow, with two Indian guides. They were friendly Seneca, paid for by the British Superintendent for Northern Indian Affairs, Sir William Johnson, who also strongly urged, we might say advise, those two Seneca to take good care of Samuel Kirkland. Johnson instructed the two Indians to deliver Kirkland safe through the wilderness and gave them a large belt of wampum to give to the Seneca chiefs in full council, along with a message from him. These two providentially provided Indians replied that they would indeed be faithful to their trust, that they would share all dangers with Samuel Kirkland, and that they would either deliver him safe to his destination, or should he fall, they would fall by his side. And so the young white missionary and the two Indians set off through the wilderness, through cold weather, through snow, for the land of the Seneca. Each night they cleared a place in the snow, built a fire, ate a sparse meal, and then laid down to sleep on hemlock branches they had cut to make a bed. On the way to the Seneca, Kirkland's company passed through the Oneida country. Here, too, the young missionary was warned, even by some of the Oneidas, that the Seneca would not receive him and that his life would be in grave peril if he didn't turn back. But, of course, Samuel Kirkland was not of the turning back kind once he was sure it was God's will that he go forward. Next, the party came into the territory of the Onondaga Nation. Now, here at the Central Council Fire of the Iroquois, that is, Central Council Fire of all six nations of the Confederacy, Samuel Kirkland explained his mission and his purpose, as well as giving the Indian sachems or chiefs present there from each nation, including the Seneca Nation, Sir William's message and the wampum belt. Finally, Kirkland's party reached, I don't know if I should hazard the name, but it is the principal town of the Seneca. They halted outside the town, as was the custom. Then, according to the same custom, a messenger from Seneca approached to ask whence they came, where they were going, and what purpose their desire. They returned the answer, "We are only bound to this place and wish to be conducted to the house of the chief sachem." The next day, the Seneca held a council at which the message from Sir William was again delivered along with more wampum which he had sent. The head sachem was friendly, but concerning some around the council fire, Mr. Kirkland wrote that he, quote, did not quite like their sullen countenances, unquote. But by the grace of God, the head sachem himself, certainly by the grace of God, was so taken with Samuel Kirkland that he adopted the missionary into his family, that is, his extended family of kinfolk. And so this tended toward the missionary's safety, of course. However, in a relatively short time, the head of one of the particular families within that whole group of kinfolk, the head of the family with whom Kirkland was staying, suddenly died for no apparent reason. So, of course, now the faith and the courage of the missionary were sorely tested. The whole village was thrown into such an uproar, as is common with superstitious heathens, in such situations. A large party of the Indians blamed Kirkland and demanded his death. After the funeral of the deceased, a young brave, Kirkland's youngest brother, his adopted brother, put a gun into his hand. The brave took another gun for himself and, leading Samuel, slipped out of the village and hid Samuel in the woods in a hut. Then for several days, the missionary just stayed put as members of the Indian family secretly brought him food. Well, after several days and much wrangling around the council fire, the head sachem and those in favor of Samuel Kirkland prevailed over those demanding his immediate death. But of course, the losing party of savages continued to nurse a great resentment and hatred of the missionary. From now on, our missionary's life was in constant danger from those who wanted to kill him. At the same time, there were some among those bloodthirsty Seneca who first had held him in utter contempt, but who gradually began to admire the young man's steadfast courage, integrity, and kindness. But at the same time, the rest only increased in murderous rage toward him, and they sought to thwart all that he attempted, and they often succeeded. It's said at that time, during that time of Kirkland's with the Seneca, he encountered such severe trials and dangers as would have appalled most men with terror and dismay. By the end of that winter, by April, the Seneca were so short of food that starvation was imminent. Kirkland and the Indians were in a deplorable, weak condition. And although the streams were still high, the missionary determined to go to Fort Bennington on Lake Oneida for life-saving supplies. A number of his adopted family insisted on going with him. Now, as I said, this trip for supplies had need to navigate Oneida Lake, which is 21 miles long and 5 miles wide. As the party was traveling on the lake while they were in the middle of it and still 12 miles from the fort, a sudden storm of hurricane force enveloped them. At this point, they altered course, and they desperately struggled toward the nearest point of land, bailing water as they went and putting blankets against leaks in the big canoe. In growing desperation, Tikanda, the missionary's adopted brother, took 2 pinches of magic powder out of a pouch he had with him. He threw the powder into the wind and he shouted, "Now, wind, do your best. Do your best, I say. You cannot conquer now." Well, almost immediately the wind increased and disaster, in fact, death appeared to be imminent. Tikanda now urged Samuel Kirkland, quote, "Brother, pray to your God now. Pray to your God, Jesus you call him. Perhaps he will save us. We are in utmost danger of perishing," unquote. Well, of this request, Kirkland recounted, "I answered that I was praying and had been all the time." After a half hour more, the party finally reached the bank with the canoe literally falling apart as it struck the beach. Here they were able to make a fire and dry out their clothes. And then as they were drying out their clothes and warming up, Kirkland related the story of Jesus on the Lake of Gennesaret and spoke of the great deliverance they had experienced only by the grace of God. Now, when the Kirkland party reached the fort, the English were absolutely shocked by Kirkland's appearance. A relief party with supplies was put together and sent back to the Seneca. Well, Samuel Kirkland's party was at the fort. His adopted sister, Tikanda's wife, died. Rather than live in comfort with the English, the missionary had been staying with the Indians, and he had done all he could for Tikanda's wife. Well, this endeared Kirkland to those Senecas with him. The party's return trip back to the Seneca Nation was also highly dangerous and very taxing since the streams were still running high. But they got back, and things went along fairly well for the young missionary among the Seneca, especially since he had proven what great concern he had for them. Things went along well until a powerful and famous Seneca chief attempted to raise a war party to raid the Cherokees. Now, this chief had no success raising warriors for that venture, so he blamed it all on Kirkland, whom he said had poisoned the minds of the young warriors with white people's notions. Full of rage, he demanded that the missionary leave the Seneca people and territory, declaring if the missionary refused, then he would kill him. Well, Kirkland refused to leave. Shortly after that, one day after visiting some Indians in another village, the missionary was returning home, riding on his pony, singing hymns as he went along, and he spotted ahead in the underbrush one of the chief's men, a very violent Indian, waiting with a gun to kill him. Well, the missionary determined to just continue singing and to ride right past that brave. The Indian called out for him to stop. Kirkland ignored him and continued on. The Indian raised his weapon, cocked it, called out for Kirkland to stop again. And into Kirkland's mind came the memory of two Americans who had been killed by Indians near that very spot. But he just rode on singing his hymn. The Indian called out again, stop. But Kirkland continued, and the Indian never fired. Clearly the Lord had stayed the would-be murderer's hand. Remember now, Samuel Kirkland had set out for the Seneca Nation in November of 1764. In a letter of response to Dr. Wheelock concerning some plans for missionary work, this letter is dated April 17, 1766, Kirkland wrote, "I shall set out for New England in the beginning of May. I am not yet fully satisfied what is duty in regard to my immediate return. The plan you have laid out for execution is very large and requires much consideration and a strict examination into the state of affairs. I am sorry so much depends on my return or an answer from me." And so the missionary left the Seneca in May. And in truth, he had made little obvious progress among those very hard-hearted heathens, the majority of which despised him, many of which wished his death, and they despised anything that had to do with the white man. But it was obvious by the time he did leave that he had been a savior of Christ among them and had planted gospel seed that would in God's own time take root in the hearts of some of them. Writing in a letter to a friend, Dr. Wheelock said of Samuel Kirkland's time among the Seneca, "This bold adventure of his, which considered in all the circumstances of it, is the most extraordinary of the kind I have ever known, and has been attended with abundant evidence of a divine blessing." Now, 1 month after returning from the Seneca on June 19th, Samuel Kirkland was ordained at Lebanon as a Presbyterian minister. He was also commissioned as a missionary by the Connecticut Board of Correspondence of the Society in Scotland for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge. Now the young minister consulted with trusted friends and men as elders in ministry as to how and where to go as a missionary. He perhaps spoke with the seasoned Indian minister and missionary Samson Ockham, who was by natural birth of the Mohegan tribe and much as elder in the ministry. The record is that Samuel Kirkland did spend time with George Whitfield, the Reverend George Whitfield, and that Whitfield encouraged the young man to go on in the work, telling him, "Go forth to the field of his Lord and manfully lay his sickle to that harvest," as Kirkland related it. Now, this, contrary to some reports, was after Kirkland returned from the Seneca, not before. Whitfield and the young Kirkland had struck up a warm fellowship, a warm friendship. Kirkland would name his first son, a twin, George Whitfield Kirkland. Samuel Kirkland ultimately chose the Oneida Nation and the region they inhabited as the people and region of his missionary labors. These Indians had been visited only several times by missionaries, including Samson Ockham, and never for a long time. They were a people living in great darkness and by their heathenish ways inflicting themselves and others with great harm. And so Samuel Kirkland traveled to the principal Oneida village and took up residence there as his base of operations. He began his labors among the Oneidas about the 1st of August, 1766, and he continued for 40 years, other than for brief necessary interruptions, and some time spent as a Continental Army chaplain. Oneida, by the way, means upright stone, from a very large rock which served as their national religious altar and around which they held ceremonies. Now, the first thing Kirkland had to do, he had need of a house to live in. He had to build a house. This obviously cut into his ministry labor somewhat, but he had little choice and no help. Having made up his mind he was with the Oneidas to stay, the missionary, according to his grandson biographer, by constant and very hard labor, dug a cellar, then cut, hewed, and dragged in timber for the house and built it. He did this in 70 days. Subsequently, an Indian student of Wheelock's, a fine and godly young man named David Fowler, was chosen by the Connecticut Board of Correspondence to join Kirkland among the Oneidas and to be a teacher. He was sent to Kirkland carrying a letter informing the missionary of his, that is, Fowler's responsibilities. Fowler also brought letters and an address from Dr. Wheelock to the Indian sachems. David Fowler and his wife Hannah were Delawares by birth. They moved into Kirkland's house with him, Hannah now taking care of the housekeeping and David helping with other duties. In a letter to Dr. Wheelock at this time, a letter which obviously took some time to arrive since it must be sent with a trusted courier when opportunity arose, Kirkland wrote of the Oneida among whom he was laboring, "Many appear to have a hearing ear and an understanding heart and to be earnestly engaged for religion." But drunkenness in this principal Oneida village was common, and the drunks were especially opposed to Kirkland and the gospel. The situation was bad enough that Kirkland called together the whole town, men and women, old and young, and he told them they must quit their drunkenness, that liquor must be outlawed, and that 6 to 8 of their chief men must be appointed and given power to assist him in seizing all liquor and destroying it, or else he would leave them. By the grace of God, there were enough Oneida leaders that approved of the plan, and Kirkland implemented it. In subsequent days, 80 kegs of rum were seized and destroyed. In the spring of 1767, Kirkland wrote in a letter to a Miss Workman, a supporter of missionary work among the Indians, "I now rejoice that I am able to tell you that through the blessing of God upon a preached gospel among the savages at Oneida, there has been for some months past and still continues to be a glorious work of God's grace. In that dark corner, which a few months ago was a habitation of cruelty and gross paganism, there is now a blessed nest of Christians, and such as were not God's people must now, in the judgment of Christian charity, be called the children of God. There, in their little despicable bark huts, the true God is now worshipped in spirit and truth, and the poor, greasy, lousy, half-starved creatures are from day to day fed with the hidden manna, and a number of them are rejoicing with joy unspeakable." Time proved that much of these first fruits of Kirkland's missionary efforts among the Oneida Indians were the real thing, with the individuals going on to live lives of sobriety, industry, integrity, and piety. That summer, there was a severe famine among the Oneida people. Samuel Kirkland wrote, "I have eaten no flesh in my own house for nigh 8 weeks. Flour and milk with a few eels has been my living. Such diet, with my hard labor abroad, does not satisfy nature. My poor people are almost starved to death. I would myself be glad of the opportunity to fall upon my knees for such a bone as I have often seen cast to the dogs." Now, at this point, David Fowler went for supplies to save Kirkland's life. Thanks to his Indian blood and his upbringing and the grace of God, David traveled on foot and alone 400 miles in total, going to Lebanon and then two other towns, gathering supplies, and then returning in time to save Kirkland's life. And he accomplished this in just 10 days. Now, it must have been a blow to our missionary when David Fowler and his wife were soon needed to go back east to Montauk, that is, Long Island, to take care of his parents, his aged and suffering parents, as it was put. Now, in spite of some progress he had made among the Oneida in this opening chapter of his work among them, there were still a great many, the majority, which had no use for Samuel Kirkland at all. In a letter to Dr. Wheelock, he wrote, "Another thing is perhaps a good omen. My name is cast out as evil. I have all manner of evil falsely spoken against me." This the missionary attributed in part to his having, quote, "a little disobliged several very inhumane, cruel, and unrighteous traders whose constant aim is to destroy the poor Indian as fast as possible. Their unchristian conduct is quite beyond the conception of a New England Christian. But the missionary also wrote, "I rejoice that I am counted worthy to suffer a little for Christ's sake. 'Tis sweet to be without any name, only in Christ. But I find I am in great danger of pride on the one hand and despondency on the other. The devil has tried for 3 years to starve me to death. When he found he could not kill me with famine, he took up the sword. Defeated there, he takes up the old weapons with redoubled force, pride and despondency. I have got sight of him. May the Lord enable me to watch." In spite of the financial straits and the shortage of supplies that he had been laboring so hard under, when the Mission Board of Trustees voted him £100 to provide him with necessaries, and a Scottish Christian named Reverend James Blaine, on hearing from reliable men of the character and work of Kirkland, sent him a gift of £30, Kirkland wrote to Reverend Blaine, "Language would fail to express the grateful emotions of my heart. I have for several months earnestly desired, if it might be the will of God, to have it in my power to relieve the necessities of several orphans among the dear, tawny people of my charge, and one or two Christian friends and relations with some of my own exigencies. You may be assured, Reverend Sir, that your liberality shall be faithfully improved according to the best of my ability and judgment. I have never had a salary since I embarked in this arduous but glorious cause, nor ever asked for one." In 1769, the Board of Correspondents appointed another man to temporarily fill Samuel Kirkland's place so he could take a very brief rest to restore his health and strength. During that time, our missionary married Jerusha Bingham, the daughter of a farmer and niece of Dr. Wheelock, a young woman said to be, quote, "of uncommon energy of character, of sterling good sense, a clear and vigorous understanding, and a devout heart with a deep and lively interest in missionary work among the Indians." Now, shortly after their wedding, Mr. and Mrs. Kirkland returned to the Oneidas, where it said that her influence was immediately felt and was extensive and beneficial in introducing order, neatness, industry, purity, and a devout spirit among the women of the nation. From this period to the Revolutionary War, Kirkland's gospel labors, his preaching and his teaching had increasing success. The Lord's Day was strictly observed by increasing numbers of Oneida. Drunkenness among them became relatively rare, and many souls were added to the church. In late 1770 or early 1771, Samuel Kirkland's ties with Dr. Wheelock and the board of the Society in Scotland for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge, these ties were severed due to some difficulties in which Dr. Wheelock was definitely to blame, though Kirkland and Wheelock subsequently mended their fences. Samuel Kirkland now became a missionary of the board to the Oneidas, and he received a yearly salary, though it certainly was not one on which he could have become financially secure by any means. With the aid of that missions board, Samuel Kirkland now set about to build a meeting house, a sawmill, a gristmill, a blacksmith shop, and to secure oxen, some farming implements, and various tools. He then began training the Indians as blacksmiths and farmers so they might be able to take better care of their families and avoid the often famines they endured during hard winters when there was a scarcity of game. In this diligent, hard labor of Kirkland's, one cannot help but be reminded of two other Presbyterian missionaries, Robert Moffat in Africa and Marcus Whitman among the Indians in the Oregon Territory. Now, during the summer of 1770, Mrs. Kirkland set out on a trip to see her parents. Along the way, she gave birth on the 17th of August at General Herkimer's house. Upon the return of the mother and the twins, the Oneidas immediately adopted the babies into the tribe, giving them each an Indian name. The Kirkland's next child was a girl who was delivered at Mrs. Kirkland's sister's home. She had traveled there sometime previous to the birth. The child lived only a few weeks. When he heard of the loss, Samuel wrote to his wife, "Notwithstanding nature sinks and the heart bleeds by such a wound, the balm of Gilead is sufficient to heal, and the consolations of the Spirit to promote exaltation in God. Even so, Father, for so it seemeth good in thy sight. How precious, how sweet the words. May this, my dear afflicted wife, be your and my portion. Let us remember that the Lord reigns and is not at all burdened with the weight of the whole universe, but attends to and orders the minutest affairs in his vast empire. Not so much as a hair of our heads shall fall unnoticed by him, much less our dear offspring. I trust, my dear, you will not dishonor your Savior or your God by an immoderate grief, murmuring, or impatience under his discipline. A must-needs-be stands in the title page of this afflictive, though in some respects dark and mysterious providence. My greatest grief is that I cannot be present to share in yours. But even in this, the Lord does right. The nature and circumstances of my business are such as to render an immediate visit to you very difficult. I cheerfully commit you to the hands of that God who hath blessed me with you. Mrs. Kirkland stayed in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. She was planning on returning in the spring of 1773 to Oneida country to be with her husband, but things in Indian country were becoming very unsettled and dangerous, with the very real prospect of war looming, that is, war between the American colonists and the British, a war which would involve the Indian tribes, thanks to the British. Now, because of this, our missionary told his wife to stay put, to buy a small farm for her and the children to live on until things were better. Samuel, of course, made brief visits to his wife and family. He did so as he was able, as often as possible, but he continued his labors among the Oneidas. Now, in the spring of 1773, the British superintendent of Indian affairs, Sir William Johnson, a wise, prudent, fair man, a man very supportive of Kirkland and his missionary work to the Indians, was replaced by Colonel Guy Johnson. Now, Colonel Johnson was a zealous Episcopalian, and he was a royalist through and through. He went to work on the Indians to win their loyalty to the Episcopalian Church and to Britain with this war looming. At the same time, Samuel Kirkland was a Puritan through and through and a stalwart American patriot. So relations between Guy Johnson and Samuel Kirkland went rapidly downhill, and Colonel Johnson set about to destroy Kirkland's personal reputation as well as his influence and work with the Oneida Indians. Colonel Johnson sent messages to the Oneida slandering Reverend Kirkland. He used the Indians against Reverend Kirkland. He did everything he could do to stir up the tribes. I say he sent some Indians that were working for him into the tribes of others and nations of others, spreading slander. Here's an example of a message he sent to the Oneida. This is from Colonel Guy Johnson. Your minister, that is Kirkland, earnestly entreated the governor and His Majesty's Council of New York to grant him 4,000 soldiers to thrash and punish the Indians in order to bring them to repentance and embracing the gospel, for nothing but force of arms would ever humble them. This, my brethren, is what displeases me, that your minister should represent Indians in such a light, and I think the time is near when I shall punish him for such conduct. Now, the Mohawks, as I spoke of Indians that helped Colonel Johnson in this campaign of slander against Kirkland, the Mohawks were very much aligned with the British. An Oneida chief publicly witnessed that in the Great Council of the Iroquois Confederation, a powerful Mohawk chief urged him to claim certain charges against Kirkland, for, he said, that would please Colonel Johnson, be very agreeable to him. And also, if the Indians knew who their minister was, that he was a descendant of those New England or Boston people who formerly murdered their king and fled for their lives when they came to this country, that the New England ministers were not true ministers of the gospel, that they held dangerous doctrines, and many other such things, he said. Now, you remember from last week's presentation that the Oneidas were part of the Six Nation Iroquois Confederation. I believe I've already mentioned that the Six Nations were Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, Tuscarora, and Seneca. Those tribes all spoke the Iroquois language and were called, in a general sense, Iroquois Indians. But as I said, they were actually of six different nations, strongly confederated together, each nation with its own government, but each also sending a number of chiefs to a great federation council. Now, in response to the many charges being leveled against Reverend Kirkland and all of the slander and rumors about him, the chief men of the Oneida Nation then held a council. And they subsequently sent a belt of wampum and a message to Colonel Guy Johnson in which they denounced the accusations and the rumors against their missionary as being untrue and said of Samuel Kirkland, "We love and esteem our father, the minister. He lives in great peace among us. He does none any harm. He meddles not with state affairs. He labors hard in doctrine and teaches us the pure word of God, and he conducts like a true minister of Jesus Christ. We therefore love our minister, and some among us begin to embrace religion. We do not desire his removal, nor are we willing to part with him, and should we do such a thing as to drive him off, we consider it as none other than saying to God, 'Depart from us.' We therefore beg that you will desist from any further attempts to drive him off." On the 18th of July, 1775, the Continental Congress, quote, "recommended to the commissioners of the Northern Department to employ the Reverend Mr. Samuel Kirkland among the Indians of the Six Nations in order to secure their friendship and to continue them in a state of neutrality with respect to the present controversy between Great Britain and these colonies." The war which was coming was crucial to the cause of both civil and religious liberty. For this reason, also because Samuel Kirkland knew, as did the Continental Congress, the brutal nature of the warfare waged by the Indian nations. For these reasons, Samuel Kirkland did what he could to convince the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederation to remain neutral should war break out, as of course it eventually did in April of 1775. Now, Reverend Kirkland made many hard, dangerous journeys to various Indian nations and took part in a number of councils. He was hopeful that the whole Six Nation Confederacy would stay out of the fight. Patriot leaders in the Continental Congress hoped and worked to keep the Indians entirely out of the war, not even recruiting them for the Patriot cause, since they feared the savage nature of Indian warfare. Meanwhile, the British, including Colonel Johnson, labored untiringly to pull all of the Indians, all of the Six Nations of the Six Tribe Iroquois Confederacy, into the war on their side. And they employed all manner of lies about the Americans, and they used much treachery, even insisting that if the Americans won the war, their plan was then to exterminate every last man, woman, and child among the Indians. And all that time, the colonists continued to urge the Indians to just remain neutral. Well, in the end, the Six Nation Confederation, except Oneida Nation and the Tuscarora Nation, joined the British. That the Oneidas and Tuscarora did not was due, for the most part, to the gospel labors and influence of Samuel Kirkland. While he ministered primarily among the Oneidas, he did go from time to time among the Tuscarora. It's most certainly true that the entreaties of Samson Ockham to the Oneidas also made a difference also. And so the Mohawk, Onondaga, Cayuga, and Seneca joined forces with the British against the American Patriots, while the Oneida and Tuscarora remained out of the war. Now, Mohawk chief Joseph Brant was the most able and active leader of the Indians who fought for the British. In the spring of 1777, large number of Iroquois joined British Colonel St. Leger to attack Fort Schuyler and ravage the Valley of the Mohawk, that is, the white settlements in the Mohawk Valley. And through the war, British agents urged the Indians to commit acts of horrible and deadly cruelty against the colonists, the men, the women, and the children. During the first 2 years of the war, those four tribes of the Iroquois Confederation fought fiercely and often savagely for the British, while the Oneida and the Tuscarora repeatedly asked the leaders of the Patriots for permission to fight with them against the British and their own Indian brothers of the Six Tribe Confederation. They became so insistent in their desire to fight for the American cause that finally, after 2 years, the Patriot leaders consented. whereupon Tuscarora and Oneida warriors entered the fight, including 250 Oneida warriors under the celebrated, the brave, the capable Chief Scanando, a Christian Indian converted under the preaching of Samuel Kirkland. The Oneida and the Tuscarora, including the Christian Indians in their ranks, fought gallantly, rendering valuable service to the cause of our nation and to liberty in the war. Now, this Chief Scanando I mentioned, who led 250 Oneida Braves, had known Kirkland since 1764 and was his warm friend. The chief requested, and he had been granted a promise that he would be buried next to Samuel Kirkland when he died, so, as he said, that he might cling to the skirts of his garments and go up with him at the great resurrection. This Christian Indian warrior lived to a ripe old age and was indeed buried next to Samuel Kirkland, the Christian minister. But quoting now from a biography of Samuel Kirkland written by his grandson concerning those Oneida and Tuscarora warriors who were Christians, the part which the Christian Indians took in the American Revolution should win them lasting honor among the patriots. Most of the younger men of the Oneida at once enlisted as soldiers. Now, General Washington asserted during the Revolutionary War that, quote, the Oneidas have manifested the strongest attachment to us throughout the dispute, unquote. During the War of Independence, Reverend Kirkland was often absent from the Indians for periods of time, good periods of time, since he was asked to serve as a brigade chaplain in the Continental Army, and he also worked at procuring intelligence from friendly Indian scouts as to enemy movements in that part of the country. In 1779, Reverend Kirkland was with General Sullivan in his campaign on the Susquehanna. Kirkland wrote to his wife, "The necessity of a just and speedy retaliation for British and savage barbarity prompts the army to encounter every fatigue and surmount every difficulty. Marks of havoc, devastations, and wrath salute our eyes wherever we walk over the fields of this once flourishing but now desolate country. And these objects awaken strange feelings in my breast, a just indignation and a deep abhorrence of pretended British clemency once so much boasted of, now blended with savage barbarity. Upwards of 150 widows were here made upon this ground in a short space of 1 hour and a half about a year ago. Are these the fruits and effects of thy clemency, O George, thou tyrant of Britain and scourge of mankind? May he to whom vengeance belongeth put forth his righteous indignation in due time. These once flourishing but now devastated fields are now cultivated by feeble hands of disconsolate widows and helpless orphans. But why dwell on the dark side? This devastation is undoubtedly a necessary link in the grand chain of events to bring about the enjoyment and establishment of the liberties and privileges of this land, that we may be a happy people and the gospel extend its benign influence over every state and the Redeemer reap a glorious and rich harvest." During the rest of the war, Kirkland spent much time laboring at Fort Schuyler, as well as also ministering to the Indians in the area. He also preached for several area church congregations who were without ministers, but he declined all invitations to take those pulpits permanently. At the end of the war, the sachems, or chiefs of the Oneida Nation, sent a letter to the missionary board pleading for Mr. Kirkland to return to them as soon as possible. I'll read you just an excerpt of one. "As you have heretofore been very kind to us, so we hope you will still continue to compassionate us. And as the Great Spirit above hath given us the light of peace once more, we hope he will, by your means, send to us again the light of his holy word, and that you will think upon our father, Mr. Kirkland, and enable him to eat his bread by our fireside. He has labored among us under great disadvantages and done everything in his power for our good. Our father, Mr. Kirkland, loves us, and we love him. He hath long had charge of us, hath long watched over us, and explained to us God's word. Fathers, we repeat our request that you will continue our father to sit by our side, to watch over us, to instruct us, and lead us in the way to heaven." The board was in favor of sending Samuel Kirkland back to the Oneidas, but no one had to convince him to go. He had already made it plain he was going back, support or no support. He found the Indians in an unsettled state due to the ravages of war. They were scattered. Their villages were destroyed. Their families were separated. The things that had been built up had been torn down and burned down. They were in extreme poverty with a scarcity of provisions. Reverend Kirkland now joined the Oneidas during this rebuilding period and suffered through, with them, frequent and severe famines. Over the next couple of years, the Mohawk, Joseph Brant, and other Iroquois Indians continued to work to turn the Oneida against the American government, but they refused to listen to such agitators. Several times, Samuel Kirkland was asked by our government to act as interpreter in treaty negotiations with various Iroquois nations in council. Now, these things we don't have time to go into any more than some of the other developments and movements among the various Indian nations at the time. We're told that the Oneidas were content with their post-war treaty arrangement with the new American government, enjoying under this treaty peace and the undisturbed possessions of their lands in the state of New York. Now Mr. Kirkland's labors among the Oneidas began once again to be fruitful. He wrote that with the exception of some diehard pagans, quote, the Indians appeared universally desirous of religious instruction, except two or three professed pagans, and would convene for that purpose at any hour in the day. I have sometimes, when traveling among them, preached a lecture at sun half an hour high in the morning. On Sundays, the Indians assembled in great crowds for the meeting, crowds so great it was necessary to hold the service out of doors. The missionary often preached until his voice failed, at which point he would have an able Christian Indian address the native congregation. In the autumn of 1785, a Cayuga chief traveled 60 miles to visit Reverend Kirkland, spending several days speaking to him of spiritual things and inquiring into Christianity. In 1786, there was a widespread spiritual awakening among the Oneida Indians under Samuel Kirkland's preaching. In the following spring, an old Indian, blind for almost 50 years, was soundly converted to Christ from a very strict religious heathen lifestyle. This influential man was known for his wisdom, and even though he wasn't a sachem, was given a seat on the council. Reverend Kirkland wrote, "The instruction of Indians appears more and more to me to be an arduous task. When their minds are thoroughly roused and they begin to believe the Bible is God's book and the religion of Jesus designed for every nation, and that they have a concern in it, they are exceedingly eager for instruction and cannot be put off with as little attention as those who have been brought up under the light of the gospel. Truly, their engagedness with the ideas of their miserable pagan state is calculated to excite the tenderest emotions in one's breast and rouse the whole soul to vigorous exertions. My ministerial labor has not been more fatiguing or incessant for these 15 years past than of late, but blessed be God, I humbly hope, never more delightful. I would acknowledge the goodness of God in the almost uninterrupted health from which I have been favored, and thereby enabled me to apply myself to ministerial duties in season and out of season. Soon after the Indians returned from their fall hunt, I had my house crowded for many weeks, together with catechumens and persons under sole concern from morning to night, and some whole nights I have sat up with them. I have reason to believe there have been more than 70 souls under very serious impressions in three villages. I think I never knew more rational and pungent convictions of divine truth among any people. There is observable in some a tincture of enthusiasm. Nevertheless, I have reason to believe there is a work of God's grace among them. The external reformation is conspicuous. It is not more than 7 months since there has been a single instance of drunkenness in two villages. Many who were formerly given to dissipation, every step of whose past life was marked with the foulest vices, have now become visibly sober, regular, industrious, praying Indians." But of course, Satan is not one to sit idle when a glorious gospel work is in progress, and so violent opposition broke out among some of the heathen Indians. For example, on the 1st of January, 1787, at a Christian meeting, several heathen Indians, instigated by a young, prideful chief, interrupted and loudly began reviling the Christians, the praying Indians, and denouncing Christianity. They urged all present to join them in the old ways and in the old religion. Well, they were rebuffed by all present. So then these Indians were filled with rage, and they conceived the plot to kill Samuel Kirkland at dusk that very day. Friends of the minister found out about this just in time and hid him away in a secluded wigwam under the guard of several chiefs and young men. The next morning, a council was held with Kirkland urged to attend. The chief Sachem addressed the council for 2 hours with great earnestness and emotion, insisting that all must declare they were either for Christianity or against Christianity. He took Kirkland by the hand and with tears in his eyes said, "Father, open your ears and let all present hear. Well, I declare in the presence of the Great Spirit that I love you, that I will die for Jesus, and I will die for you, Father, any day. Leave us not, I entreat you. We are an undone people if you leave us. This is my opinion. Let everyone disclose his sentiments as in the name of Jesus." The rest of the day and most of the next were spent in council. Finally, at the end of it, the guilty Indians came forward. They publicly acknowledged their wrong conduct and guilt and asked to be pardoned. Peace then returned. Immediately after that, several Christian chiefs came to Kirkland, and they suggested that he preach on persecution now, specifically that which he and some of the Christian Indians had suffered. One of these Oneida chiefs took the liberty to suggest a certain sermon topic to the minister. Quote, "The history of Paul's life previous to his conversion to Christianity, how he held the old way, the tradition of the fathers, and though he was serving the great God of Israel, while he was fighting and kicking against Jesus." The chief said if Reverend Kirkland would preach on such a thing, then the Indians, he said, will see to what wickedness, pride, and darkness of mind will lead them. About this time, Samuel Kirkland wrote, "I had abundant reason to bless God for this day. I do not recollect to have attended so solemn and affectionate a meeting with my Indians for near 14 years past. Many followed me from the place of public worship to my own house, the distance of a mile, and tarried till evening. Their applications for instruction were so incessant that I could get no leisure to take any refreshment till late in the evening. Near 9 o'clock I received an earnest request to pray and sing a psalm or two with a number who were convened in a neighboring house and say a few words if I was not too weary." This spiritual awakening among the Oneidas continued through the spring of 1787. Samuel Kirkland preached almost every day at one or another of the villages, with Indians also traveling up to 30 miles to join the services and speak with him about eternal things. In May 1787, he wrote, "After public exercises, it being a very pleasant evening, I walked out about 10 o'clock and was exceedingly delighted to hear them at their family devotions, singing God's praise and calling upon his name in their respective families in one or another quarter of the town." Now, of course, Mrs. Kirkland had been very much wanting to rejoin her husband among the Oneidas. He certainly wanted her to come and the children. They hadn't been able to because of the unsettled state of things until now. He had been visiting her and their children at Stockbridge, where their farm was, as often as possible. Things were now looking up, and there was good reason to hope the family would finally be together for good. But Mrs. Kirkland was not to return to the mission field. In late 1787, Mr. Kirkland came to Stockbridge in a very cheerful mood due to the abundant success of the gospel among his Oneidas. He arrived to find his wife very ill, and she subsequently died in January. One of the sons of Samuel and Jerusha, John Thornton Kirkland, later wrote of his mother, "For the first part of my college life, I was as happy as perhaps anyone ever was for so long a time together. One misfortune befell me in my junior year, which this world can never repair. My mother, on the 23rd of January, 1788, died. The highest pleasure I could enjoy was that of pleasing her, and her influence over me was so great that I never deviated from rectitude without feeling myself particularly culpable on her account. Her affection for her children was as great as her sensibility was exquisite. She seldom spoke of their welfare without tears, nor ever remitted her exertions to promote it. She found her chief consolation under every sorrow and disappointment in religion. In the doctrines and promises of Christianity, she had an unshakable faith. Its precepts were her delight, and their practice her ornament. In her expiring moments, she felt its supporting power. When she perceived the hand of death ready to snatch her, she bid a calm farewell to her surrounding friends, and with a joyful confidence committed her spirit to her Savior. May her early and constant instructions, her earnest exhortations to goodness, her excellent example and triumphant death be indelibly impressed on the minds of her children and form the directory of their lives. John Thornton Kirkland subsequently served as president of Harvard College from 1810 to 1828. With the death of his wife, Samuel Kirkland decided for the time to keep his children still at home at that same homestead and put them under the charge of one said to be an excellent and prudent lady who was a very close friend of Mrs. Kirkland's. The missionary spent much of the summer of 1788 visiting the western nations of the Six-Tribe Confederacy, gathering information with an eye toward organizing more missionary work among them. He visited many villages and historical sites, including a battlefield where the Seneca fought the western Indian tribes, those to the west of them, with the result that 800 warriors were killed in that one battle. The Seneca informed Kirkland they did not want a missionary like him. They wanted a Roman Catholic, they said, or an Episcopalian priest. Now, during this trip, Reverend Kirkland attended and spoke at a council which drew 4,350 Indians. Upon his return to the Oneida Indians to resume his missionary labors among them, he found that the influence and intrigues of French Roman Catholic traders were hindering him to some degree. These traders, working under the guidance and direction of a Roman Catholic Jesuit priest, were using all manner of deception, duplicity, and slander against Samuel Kirkland. They were smearing his character and his work. The Jesuit priest took up residence in Oneida territory, and he began to draw some of the Indians away to popery. The Jesuit showed up in an Indian council with a bogus letter from the French ambassador to America, which urged the Indians to give the priest 300 acres to clear a field for him and to build him a house. And the traders, of course, supported the priest in his demands. Now, the Indians refused to give in to his demands, but the priest stayed anyway, and he continued his constant agitation and machinations and proselytizing of the Indians at every chance. That year was also a famine year, which added to the hardships of Samuel Kirkland and the Indians. Well, the animosity and the tension and the conflicts caused by the Jesuit priests and the Roman Catholic traders reached a point to where both parties, there were now two parties of Indians, wrote to Governor Clinton of New York. He wrote back to the Indians telling them that the Romanists were only attempting to deceive them, not to pay any attention to them, and telling the Indians that they, quote, have a right to worship God in a manner most agreeable to them, but I approve of your determination to adhere to your old minister, unquote. This letter helped to quiet things down a great deal and probably averted violence between the two Indian parties. At this time, Reverend Kirkland was preaching and ministering on a circuit of six different Oneida towns, including the chief town. He preached three times every Sunday. He held evening conferences in matters temporal and spiritual during the week. These conferences often lasted past midnight. Early in December of 1790, the Indian chiefs of the Six Nations, particularly Joseph Brant, asked Samuel Kirkland to travel to Philadelphia, which was our nation's capital then, with a delegation of Seneca Indians to present some grievances before Congress and to ask for aid in introducing agriculture and the arts of civilized life among the Seneca. The head of the delegation was a captain, as he was known, Captain Abiel. He was better known as Corn Planter, a celebrated and powerful chief of the Seneca Nation. Now, Samuel Kirkland had come to know Corn Planter 6 years earlier. He was very, very committed to his Indian religion. During the trip to Philadelphia and while there, Kirkland had time to witness much to Corn Planter, and the Spirit of Grace began an obvious work in the heart of this Indian sachem. Reverend Kirkland wrote, "I do not now regret my journey. I think I never enjoyed more agreeable society with any Indians than Captain Abiel has afforded me. He seems raised up by Providence for the good of his nation. He exhibits uncommon genius, possesses a very strong and distinguishing mind, and will bear the most mental application of any Indian I was ever acquainted with. When the business he came upon did not require his immediate attention, he would be incessantly engaged in conversation upon the subject of divine revelation. He appeared anxious as well as curious in his inquiries for the evidences of the scripture account of creation, the Christian scheme of doctrine, and the effects Christianity would produce upon the various nations of the earth under the administration of the Son of God. He would many times not leave the subject short of 3 and 4 hours. For the last week I was with him, he would not allow the sachems and warriors to sit down at mealtime without having me ask the divine blessing upon the food. At our parting, he observed to me that his business with Congress was settled to his satisfaction, and he believed it would gratify every wish of his nation, and he should return well stored with provisions, by the way, but through the wonderful good providence of God, he had a richer store of spiritual food, out of which he could take a portion for his mind to feed upon and digest every day through the long journey, and that he could not sufficiently thank the Great Spirit for allowing him this opportunity of being so long with me." Samuel Kirkland left Philadelphia. He visited his children at Stockbridge, and he was back among his duties. He was back at his duties among the Oneida in February, preaching, as I said, 3 times on Sunday at various villages, visiting the sick, holding 2 or 3 meetings a week for preaching and teaching, also instructing the Indians in practical matters such as agriculture and helping them in the actual work of farming. In April, he was asked to take part in a grand Indian council held to settle difficulties between the Wolf tribe and the Turtle and Bear tribes caused by the intrigues of the Romanist traders. Thanks to Kirkland's active involvement, the matter was settled to the satisfaction of both parties, and violence was averted. Now, during this time, Kirkland prepared what he called a plan of education for the Indians, particularly of the 5 nations. You remember the Mohawks were now in Canada. At this time, the constantly busy missionary was also involved in trying to put an end to warfare between the Western Indians, such as the Miami, and the United States. In 1791, he completed also a statement of the numbers and situation of the 6 tribes of the Indians in North America. This was an accurate census, which was received also by the American Academy of Arts and Science, which had chosen him as a member previously. Now, all during this, Samuel Kirkland's missionary labors and ministry labors among the Indians continued to be his principal concern and claim his most ardent attention, including beyond the Oneida. He and his Christian Indian brethren also labored during this period to put an end to drunkenness and horrible nighttime revelries taken part in by many Indians among several nations. Resistance to the missionary and the faith he preached continued even among gospel victories. As an example of this, I want to submit this statement from an old Tuscarora chief as he confronted a grandchild who was showing much interest in the gospel and the faith of Christ. He said to this grandchild, "Well, grandchild, you are going to become one of those Christians who worship God by a book, and you will go to a place which their book tells of when you die. But no one has been there and returned to acquaint you with the nature of that place and the mode of their living. Grandchild, I have repeatedly warned you of this and told you to make your choice. If you choose an uncertainty for a certainty, you must abide the consequences. My brother came to me on a friendly visit the last night. He came direct from Escanane, the city of departed spirits. I asked him if he came to call me to go and take up my final residence with my forefathers in Escanane. He replied, 'Not yet. You are to tarry here a little longer. But I came to inform you that your old friends are happy there and wait your arrival, and that your apartment is prepared for you. And in 3 moons I shall return with orders to conduct you safe to your fathers.' Now, grandchild, the Christian's book knows nothing of this, nor does it know anything with respect to the government of our island. He was talking about the nation. Our island is supported by four little gods. One resides at the east, called, and he gives the Indian name. Another at the west, Indian name. Another at the north, again the Indian name, and a fourth at the south. Grandchild, the Christian's book knows nothing of all this. Indeed, it knows nothing about Indians. Grandchild, this is my last warning to you. Within 3 months, my brother will be sent by the spirits of my fathers to call me. Then I shall bid you farewell. And if you forsake the path of your forefathers, I shall never see you again. Well, within 3 months, his chief died. He died quietly with no suffering at all. That's true, isn't it? For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Now, we don't have time to speak here of additional invaluable service rendered by Kirkland during this period. After American forces under General St. Clair were routed by the Miami Indians and the British were seeking to induce all of the Iroquois to join the Western tribes to fight the Americans. They were unsuccessful in that, and part of the reason is because of Kirkland's influence. In October of 1791, Reverend Kirkland moved his family, though still children, to the log home he had built in Oneida Country. He continued his missionary labors among the Indians, and now the plan of education for the Indians, which he had drawn up, was put in practical application, with schools being built and enlarged. More mills were also built. More places of worship were erected. The missionary was able to secure additional oxen, plows, and other farming implements, which were distributed among the Oneida people, who had now become, for the most part, an industrious, thrifty, and intelligent people. The next year, as Samuel Kirkland was going from place to place on horseback, a small branch, which he was pushing out of his way, slipped and struck him in his left eye. Within a few days, that eye became badly inflamed, and then it began to flare up the nerves and affect the sight of his other eye as well. Well, Reverend Kirkland continued preaching and pursuing his other duties, but he had such great pain and discomfort. And finally, his sight and his health was so adversely affected that he had to travel east to a doctor, but his eyes ever after gave him much trouble. In August of 1792, Kirkland preached a message at the funeral of that choice servant of the Lord, Samson Ockham. Earlier, he had preached at the funeral of Samson Ockham's daughter, who died young. After the death of Reverend Ockham, Samuel Kirkland, as he could make time, would now also occasionally travel to the Christian Indian town Ockham had established called Brother Town and preach to that little flock, which was now without a shepherd. Eventually, it was those Indians plus the Stockdale Indians who immigrated to our state of Wisconsin when it was yet mostly wilderness and settled on land they purchased from the Winnebago tribe. Now, Samuel Kirkland now determined to establish a high school or academy in Oneida Country, which young Indians selected from various Indian nations and also some white frontier youth would attend for higher education, including instruction in the doctrines of Christianity. This proposal was warmly endorsed by various government officials, including President Washington, whom Kirkland met with in Philadelphia. A charter for the school was obtained, and it was given the name of Hamilton Oneida Academy. That school is now called simply Hamilton College. Hamilton Oneida Academy was built on several hundred acres of land donated by Samuel Kirkland. This was frontier land which had been given him earlier out of gratitude by the Indians. And that's not all. He didn't only donate the land that Hamilton Oneida Academy was built on, but he also contributed financially out of the little he had to this academy for Indian and poor white frontier youth. The preamble of the deed to the land Reverend Kirkland donated includes this: a serious consideration of the importance of education and an early improvement and cultivation of the human mind, together with the situation of the frontier settlements of this part of the state, though extensive and flourishing, yet destitute of any well-regulated seminary of learning, has induced and determined me to contribute of the ability wherewith my heavenly benefactor hath blessed me towards laying the foundation and support of a school or academy in the town of Whitestone and county of Herkimer, contiguous to the Oneida Nation of Indians, for the mutual benefit of the young and flourishing settlements in this said country and the various tribes of Confederate Indians, earnestly wishing the institution may grow and flourish, that the advantages of it may be extensive and lasting, and that under the smiles of God, the God of wisdom and goodness, it may prove an eminent means of diffusing useful knowledge, enlarging the bounds of human happiness, aiding the reign of virtue in the kingdom of the blessed Redeemer. The Hamilton Oneida Academy was soon up and running. It became an important center of learning, producing very good results in the higher education, both academic and religious, of Indians and poor white frontier youth. Under God, the Academy owed its origin to Samuel Kirkland's perseverance and sacrifice. Now, from this point on, the aging missionary continued his faithful labors among the Oneidas and also other Indians. And as his biographer tells us, he, quote, took a lively interest in all that related to the welfare and improvement of the intelligent and enterprising Christian community which had gathered around him. He's talking about the Oneidas now, and converted into a garden of beauty that wilderness which he had first trod many years before as a solitary and self-sacrificing missionary. However, the 15 years which Samuel Kirkland lived after this included much sickness and severe pain. He also endured financial embarrassments which were not his fault, the loss of loved ones, and other painful trials. His eyes continued to give him a great deal of trouble. He wrote concerning that, "I can write but a few lines at a time, and some days none at all. Blessed be God, that a disposition to reflection and meditation increases in some proportion to the failure of the faculty of vision. May this trying and instructive providence be suitably improved by me. I feel as though the thought of losing my eyes would be utterly insupportable, but nothing is impossible with God. And if I am united to his kingdom by benevolent and holy affection, I may be assured all things shall work for my good." In September of 1795, Reverend Kirkland's horse stumbled. It threw him. He landed on hard, stony ground. He was unconscious for some time, and he never fully recovered. From then on, he suffered from much intense pain and difficulty in various parts of his body affected by the fall. He also had severe attacks of pleurisy. In spite of it all, Samuel Kirkland continued to minister among his Oneida. However, jealous men were circulating evil rumors about him. In the spring of 1797, due to Kirkland's many physical problems, and perhaps in part because of evil rumors they had heard, the missionary board sent the old missionary word that because of his physical ailments, they were dissolving instantly all connection with him. Well, all along, Samuel Kirkland had used as much of his salary as possible in charity toward the Indians. And his house was constantly visited by Indians from all the Six Nations in their wanderings. They were constantly coming to him for assistance or advice in matters both temporal and spiritual. They often kept him up all night. It wasn't unusual for him to feed 70 to 100 Indians in the course of 1 week. But to the mission board, Samuel Kirkland wrote, "Whether I hold the office of missionary or not, while I live and have any capacity for service, I must do much of the duty. I know their language and manners. I love them and they me." 2 years later, one of Reverend Kirkland's sons, George Whitfield Kirkland, who was much engaged in business and speculations and for whom Kirkland was a bondsman, failed in business and Kirkland lost everything but his homestead. From then on, he had great financial struggles just to make ends meet. In 1805, his youngest son Samuel died in Boston. In the same year, his son George Whitfield died in Jamaica, leaving him with only one son who informed him of the deaths of the other two in a letter. Well, Samuel Kirkland bore it all with patience and with fortitude. His letters at the time and his journal contained not a trace of bitterness or anger. He continued on with an unshakable faith and trust in the Lord and the joyful anticipation of the glories and bliss of heaven. In spite of everything, Samuel Kirkland continued to sacrifice for the gospel and the Indians and continued to serve the Lord in ministry as much as possible until, having fought the good fight and finished his course, he went to be forever with the Lord on the 28th of February, 1808. And he had a wonderful reunion with his wife, Jerusha, as well. Reverend Kirkland was buried beside his wife, Jerusha, and one of their daughters, both of them on his one side. And on his other side was later buried the Oneida chief, the Christian warrior, Skenando. It's perhaps very fitting that we close this brief look at the long life and faithful labors of Samuel Kirkland, missionary to the Oneida, by reading what's inscribed on a monument which has been placed over the Christian Indian chief buried at his side, a testimony of the powerful, effectual working of the Holy Spirit by the gospel of Christ Jesus. This monument is erected by the Northern Missionary Society in token of their respect for the memory of Skenando, a chief of the Oneida Nation, who died in the peace and hope of the gospel on the 11th of March, 1860. Zealous and brave, he long swayed the councils of his tribe, whose confidence and devotion he eminently enjoyed. In the war which placed the Canadas under the crown of Great Britain, he was actively engaged against the French. In that of the Revolution, he espoused the cause of the colonies and ever afterwards remained a firm friend of the United States. Under the ministry of the Reverend Mr. Kirkland, he embraced the doctrines of the gospel and bravely exhibited their power in a long life adorned by every Christian virtue. He fell asleep in Jesus at the advanced age of 100 years.